It's Friday, July 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Hillary Clinton is set to accept her party's nomination for president. We'll go live to the Democrat convention. Political and military shakeups continue in Turkey.
There doesn't seem to be any other motive for this killing other than to make a statement.
The Pope reacts to the murder of an elderly priest. Also ahead, efforts to protect civilians in Syria and alternative energy to move the masses. It's all on today's International Edition. Hillary Clinton, a fixture on the American political scene for a generation, will, a short time from now, accept the Democratic presidential nomination and tell Americans why they should trust her to be the new American leader after President Barack Obama leaves office in January. At the Democrat National Convention in Philadelphia on Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden made a strong attack against Mrs. Clinton's rival, Republican nominee Donald Trump.
How can there be pleasure in saying you're fired? He's trying to tell us he cares about the middle class. Give me a break. That's a bunch of malarkey.
President Obama followed with his explanations of why voters should choose Hillary Clinton.
There has never been a man or a woman, not me, not Bill, nobody, more qualified than Hillary Clinton to serve as president of the United States of America.
And Bill, of course, would be her husband, Bill Clinton. Mrs. Clinton is the first U.S. woman to become a major party's presidential nominee, and according to a recent Gallup poll, is the country's most admired woman. And yet, a majority of U.S. voters also tell pollsters they do not trust her, conflicting views that have left her locked in a tight contest with Mr. Trump. There seems to be little conflict of choice inside the convention hall, and our best choice to tell us more about the final day of this gathering is VOA's Doug Bernard. Doug, this is the big night Hillary Clinton has been waiting for.
Well, Jim, I guess I accept humbly your nomination. And real quick, I have to say, I think Joe Biden is the only politician on the national stage who can use the word malarkey non-ironically. So this whole week is, thinking back on it, it's almost been, and the analogy isn't the strongest, but setting the kettle on the stove. You know, from the very beginning, they were trotting out, they were bringing out Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren. Yes, of course, there were some boos and some frustration and hurt feelings. And then Michelle Obama's address, you know, and the kettle was heating up. And then the next night you saw President Clinton come out and really just add, you know, color and warmth to this person that we're all familiar with, but maybe not a lot of Americans don't know. And then leading through last night, the speeches, as you mentioned, by President Obama, Vice President Biden, Michael Bloomberg giving a really kind of a surprising and a bit of a, you know, rip-snorting speech himself. And now we're at the point where that kettle is just about to boil, and I think for the delegates in the hall tonight, there's no question that, you know, the kettle's going to boil, it's going to whistle, it's going to be a dramatic and memorable event in the hall. Now, here's the question. Is that going to translate in a meaningful way to the millions of Americans who are watching on television this evening? Obviously, we can't say that's what they're hoping for, but, you know, we just have to wait and see.
Well, Donald Trump's speech was described as rather very dark, a dire assessment of the United States and our place in the world. And yet he did get a pretty good bounce in poll numbers. Hillary Clinton, we suspect, is going to be painting a much brighter picture of the United States, its state, and looking for that similar bump in the polls.
Yeah, no, that's a good summary. Now, so far, the Clinton camp has not yet started to release speech excerpts. They've really been holding those close. Usually at this point, campaigns just start, you know, dribbling out some excerpts for the media to start chewing over and talking about. But, you know, Donald Trump's speech, again, was, I think, seen by a number of people as being in some ways pessimistic. Now, for his credit, Mr. Trump said later that he saw the speech as optimistic because he was looking problems square in the eye and, you know, promising, I will fix these. But I think in tone, just as we've seen in the conventions overall, comparing the two, tonight's address by Mrs. Clinton will be, we're all fairly certain, more forward-looking. Of course, she'll have some barbs in there about her opponent, but really trying to kind of paint a picture of what she wants to do, where she would like the country to move forward, and then this basically, I think what we have now is we will have at the end of tonight the two campaigns set up, their big messages moving into November. One campaign is betting Americans are more worried and concerned and frustrated and angry, and so that is a vote for change. Another campaign, I think, is going to be voting that Americans, you know, they realize that there are problems, but they want to be hopeful, they want to be optimistic, and that's going to be their message.
Well, and this is the big springboard into yet six right. more months of campaigning.
Yeah.
Well, Doug Barnard, we thank you so much for giving us the inside scoop from the convention. And thank you so much for all of your days of work, both in the Democratic and Republican National Conventions.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on these last 2 weeks. It's been a real thrill.
Well, also a thrill for us is to find out what's buzzing online and to have our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, right here in the studio to share a summary of the reaction to the Democratic National Convention. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The big stories online today all seem to have this in common: the nominees' families. But the biggest story of them all isn't even about Hillary Clinton's family, although it is a final day of the DNC. It's about Melania Trump. Her website was taken offline after many people questioned her academic credentials. She tweeted and even wrote in her Facebook post that it was removed because it does not accurately reflect my current business and professional interests.
That's a bit of a vague statement. What does that mean?
So it's widely thought to be about her claims of having a graduate degree from the University of Slovenia. This is a top comment to her Facebook post. A user named Liza wrote, "Not that it doesn't reflect your current business and professional interests, but you lied that you graduated from the University of Slovenia with a degree when you actually only completed a year and flunked a couple of your exams." But to counter that comment, another person named Brian wrote, "I don't know, I don't care. You got my vote. I have turned off the hoopla media and just waiting until November. No worries. Be happy."
Well, I do see that MelaniaTrump.com now redirects visitors to Trump.com.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about Hillary Clinton's daughter. That, of course, is Chelsea. She's scheduled to speak later. What's the buzz about that?
So Chelsea Clinton is already trending on social media even before her speech because of her interview with Glamour magazine on Facebook Live. She was asked about her friend Ivanka Trump's speech last week, and Ivanka Trump asserted her father is a feminist and would fight for equal pay. Now, to that comment, Chelsea Clinton asked, "How would your father do that?" and argued that the Republican nominee has yet to present concrete ways to execute the plans he promised to his supporters. Jim, back to you.
Well, thanks for that great wrap-up, G. As always, you may tweet us your comments and questions. Our International Edition Twitter stream is found at VOA_IE. Also, you may find myself and G on Twitter at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories in Asia, deadline looms for displaced Pakistanis living in Afghanistan. Indonesia rebuffs United Nations and EU appeals to halt executions. Brother killed Pakistani social media star over taunts by friends. Australian police investigate Vatican official over child abuse allegations. U.S. auto execs agree with Trump on unfair South Korea trade deal. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website, also through our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is expected to embark on a major shakeup of the country's armed forces 2 weeks after a military-led coup attempt failed, prompting an ongoing crackdown. On Wednesday, hundreds of military personnel suspected of being sympathizers of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen were dismissed and dozens of media outlets closed. Gulen is accused of being behind the failed July 15th coup. He has denounced the coup and denies any involvement. Aaron Stein, a Turkish expert at the Washington-based Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the government's crackdown has wide support within the country.
And I would say a vast majority of Turks believe that the crackdown is both justified and matches with what took place. And so there is a narrative clash going on between, say, the Western countries and Turkey about the way in which to respond to this coup attempt. What we need to be concerned about is not so much the crackdown, it's that well over 40% now of Turkish admirals and generals have been implicated and discharged from the military for alleged involvement in this attempted coup. And so you have a top level of the Turkish military, a member of NATO, whose most senior officers, half of which have been discharged for alleged involvement in this.
Is it a surprise to you the breadth of the crackdown? And the prime minister indicated Wednesday that there's no end in sight with regard to this crackdown.
The crackdown needs to be viewed again within context of what's been going on in Turkey. You know, since, I would say, January 2014, there's been wide-scale purges of people suspected of being allied with Fethullah Gulen, the guy that the Turks claim has masterminded the attempted coup. And so these lists, or at least these people who are being forced to resign or being fired from their positions, are part and parcel of this larger thing that has been taking place. And I do think that the government believes that now is their time. They have political support for this. Now is the time to eradicate their influence within the Turkish bureaucracy completely. Otherwise, you risk losing the coalition supporting you domestically.
Is there a Gulen faction firmly entrenched in Turkish society?
They don't have much political power, and I would say that Gulenists in general, as a movement, have incredibly high unfavorable ratings, and so that's one of the reasons why the purges have considerable support inside of Turkey. But I think what the big question, it's the million-dollar question, and nobody quite knows because the movement is very opaque and there's not a lot of trust in the Turkish government, a lot of the claims, is how much Gulenist infiltration is there within the bureaucracy, and to what degree the burden of proof is being put upon these people for actually affiliation with the movement as they're being forced to resign or being purged.
Aaron, there's a large-scale shakeup of the Turkish armed forces expected to be announced as early as Thursday when its Supreme Military Council meets. What impact will this have on the fight against Islamic State and Turkey's membership in NATO?
I mean, I think for the U.S. particularly, it won't have very much effect, again, because the air base from which the strikes are being opened, I think, will be largely left untouched. And the U.S. isn't asking Turkey to do very much in the fight against Islamic State, simply police the border and leave the air base open. The way in which this will boomerang is that for the Turkish component of the Islamic State, they could become more active inside Turkey itself. So Turkey faces a far greater threat, I think, now from ISIS, just because the security apparatus is in a little bit of disarray right now, and they're being asked to concentrate on a very wide-scale threats. And so they have to pick and choose, and ISIS could fall by the wayside.
Aaron Stein says the matter of Fethullah Gulen's extradition will put a great strain on the U.S.-Turkish relationship in the coming months. He says Washington will have to take the matter seriously if Turkey provides the evidence that meets the standard of the two countries' bilateral extradition treaty. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu says four corridors will be set up to permit civilians and unarmed fighters to leave the now besieged rebel-held eastern districts of Aleppo in Syria. The Syrian government is promising amnesty to fighters who surrender within 3 months. Edward Uranian has more for VOA from Cairo.
The Russian defense minister's announcement of a humanitarian operation to evacuate civilians and unarmed fighters from rebel-held eastern parts of Aleppo came after Syrian government forces set up a roadblock to close the Castello Road supply route and lay siege to the area. Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu told a press conference in Moscow that Russia and the Syrian government would set up four corridors for those trapped in the besieged quarters of the city to leave.
He says Russia is inviting humanitarian organizations to join the operation with Syrian authorities to help civilians living in the rebel-held districts of Aleppo and fighters who choose to lay down their arms to leave the city via humanitarian corridors.
كل من حمل السلاح أو حاره لأي سبب من الأسباب وكان فارا من وجه العدالة أو متواريا عن الأنظار.
Syrian State TV read a statement by President Bashar al-Assad promising amnesty to rebel fighters who surrender voluntarily within the next 3 months. But Aleppo Governor Mohammed Marwan Olabi claimed rebel factions are preventing civilians who want to leave the now besieged east of the city from doing so. Syrian government military forces recaptured the Beni Zaid district of Aleppo from rebel factions overnight. State TV showed military units controlling the area. The UN indicated Thursday its deputy special envoy for Syria, Ramzi Azzedine Ramzi, would visit the country over the weekend to discuss recent developments. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Pope Francis said Wednesday the murder of an elderly French priest by two Islamists this week proves the world is at war because it has lost the peace. He said it is not a religious war, but a conflict over clashing interests, money, resources, and domination. The Reverend Brian Lucas is national director of the Australia-based Catholic Mission. He says the comments by the Pope reflect his growing anxiety about extremism.
Why kill a Catholic priest in the middle of a religious service? You know, he's an 80-year-old man. There doesn't seem to be any other motive for this killing other than to make a statement. And, of course, that statement is an ideological statement, and it's a statement about power. And as the Pope is saying, a war's going on a number of fronts. There's war because different groups want to seize power. They want to create that mayhem and terror as a way of asserting some form of ideological superiority. And what we have to be very careful of, and I think the Pope has been very, very cautious about this, is not to say that this war is somehow Islam against Christianity or Islam against secularism. This is not a war that can be simply reduced to conflict between religions, because as he rightly says, all religions, truly understood, want peace. It's the very nature of a relationship with God, that people who have some sense of belief in God and have an ethic that flows from that, and the fundamental ethic of so many religions is what we call the golden rule, treat others as you would like to be treated. If that's the basis of most religious belief, then of course it follows necessarily that religious belief leads people to want to live in peace and harmony.
Despite jihadist-inspired attacks in recent days in France and Germany and growing concerns militants may be taking advantage of the migration crisis affecting Europe, Pope Francis appealed to Polish officials to have a spirit of readiness to welcome those fleeing war and hunger and deprived of their fundamental rights. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Imagine a way to move a lot of people all at once without using any gas or oil. Well, right now in Uganda, there is a solar-powered bus described by its makers as the first in Africa. Akira Motors electric bus made its public debut recently at a stadium in Uganda's capital. From Kampala, Maurice Megaroni filed this report, narrated by Salem Solomon.
Kayula is the brand name for this bus, powered by solar panels on its roof. It seats 35 passengers, and its maker, Kira Motors, hopes the Kayula could become the first public bus in Africa to be powered by the sun. The engines of these electronically powered buses are completely silent, says the chief engineer of the project.
With this bus, there's actually no engine. What is driving the bus is a motor, a traction motor, which is being run by a battery. And the battery banks are the ones that are linked to the solar system that's on the roof. So we have the batteries that are driving the motor, and that gives us a full range of 8 kilometers on full charge. And then the solar panels come in to supplement the extra, you know, mileage. So it adds an extra 12 kilometers to the total.
The Kayula bus can be recharged using solar power or connected to an electronic power source. Best of all, it doesn't emit harmful carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
The systems are fully run on green energy. So things to do with polluting the environment, which ultimately will affect, and that's the reason why you'd work on such a product. So, because in the future, when looking at sustainable and green energy,
this solar-powered bus also helps save money on petrol by relying 100% on abundant, renewable sunlight.
The difference between this Kayula bus, the solar bus, and these other buses is that the other ones are using fuel. This one is using batteries. But as you're driving, when you're accelerating, you can't tell. It's powerful like these other buses.
The price of this prototype bus is estimated at more than $140,000. If this model can be mass-produced, the price will drop and will sell for around $55,000 each. However, before the Kayula bus is out on Ugandan roads, customers have to be patient. There hasn't been an official date set for its release. Salem Solomon for Marcus Mugrini, VOA News.
We invite you to stay tuned to VOA's coverage of Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech. We'll present this historic event on radio, TV, and the internet. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com and also online. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 28th, we observe the 65th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of one of the most important humanitarian documents of the modern era, the UN Convention relating to the status of refugees. Better known as the 1951 Refugee Convention, it is a multilateral treaty that defines who is a refugee and sets out the rights of individuals who are granted asylum. The Refugee Convention is the first international agreement dealing with the most fundamental aspects of a refugee's life, beginning with the requirement that signatory nations must protect all refugees that are on their territory. It also stipulates that refugees must be allowed certain freedoms, including the right to practice their religion, the right to work, and the right to acquire an education. They must be allowed access to travel documents and should be allowed freedom of movement. The UN Refugee Convention also emphasizes that refugees have certain obligations to the host government, such as to respect the laws and regulations of their country of asylum. Most importantly, the convention makes it very clear that a refugee may not be repatriated involuntarily to a country where he or she fears persecution. The document stemmed from the refugee crisis of 1945, when over 40 million people who were displaced by the Second World War flooded Europe in need of resettlement. Today, we find ourselves in the midst of another refugee crisis, the largest the world has seen since the catastrophe that spurred the creation of the document in the first place. According to UNHCR estimates, more than 20 million people around the world meet the convention's definition of a refugee. On this, the 65th anniversary of the signing of one of the cornerstone documents that defines our common humanity, let us not forget our history and work toward never repeating it again. Let us open our hearts to refugees wherever they are, help however and whenever we can, until such a time that they can make their way back home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.